Fell off the weekend, which is a holiday weekend here for us in the U.S. For Memorial Day. Happy Memorial Day, everybody. As we go into a Fight Freaks Unite recap off of world title fights, huge knockout for Luis Alberto Lopez, revenge for Lee Wood, controversial scoring for Chris Billum-Smith. I mean, my Lord, did we have any action? And a welterweight prospect for Golden Boy that's looking better and better in Alexis Rocha. We've got all of this to go over. Thank you for finding us. I am the somewhat competent host, TJ Reeves. He is our insider, Fight Freaks Unite, Substack, BigFightWeekend.com. Hello, Dan Rayfield. Good to be back with you with plenty to go over.
Oh, yeah. We had a pretty busy weekend. I was trying to juggle three different browsers and streams at the same time. You know what struck me, by the way? And it speaks to our times, right? So we had the Rocha show on DAZN, the Laura Wood show on DAZN, the ESPN Plus car with Lopez and Conlon, and the Billum-Smith and Okoli fight, which in the United States was on the Fight app. Four shows of consequence, three with world championship fights, not a single one of them on linear television. I watch everything on streaming.
That's correct.
For the kids, they get it. For old guys like us, that's like a weird thing to me.
But why do you keep bringing up old? We're older. Are we really old? I don't know if we're old yet. Maybe we're getting older.
Like, I don't know. Like when I was growing up, if you wanted to watch boxing, we had four channels. You put on usually any one of ABC, CBS, or NBC, nothing on PBS, you know, and you watched that boxing on those three channels. And then if you had cable, if you were lucky and your parents sprung for it, you know, you could maybe watch boxing on HBO or maybe boxing on Showtime. That was basically it.
Or on the Tuesday night fights or ESPN's fights, top ranked boxing fights on ESPN.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, the
big title fights, you know,
the times have changed. And here was the difficulty for me in the afternoon trying to manage this for the site, et cetera. I only have so many computer screens, including with my TV, trying to manage these all at once. And you only have so many eyeballs. And I did liken it. It's almost like the NCAA tournament in March in college basketball when you've got four games going on at once, or an NFL Sunday where you're trying to watch all the games at once or keep track of five or six of them on a Sunday afternoon, sometimes at once. It's a challenge. But football's different, Rayfield, because they play for like 10 seconds on a play or 5 seconds, and then they take a little break, and you can watch this screen over here and watch another play. And you can't do that with boxing and constant action. You can't divert away from this screen to look at this screen because you're going to miss big punches or knockdown. I know you're feeling me on that. It's not the same thing.
Well, what I typically will do, and I get people who like hit me up on social media, like, you know, how are you going to watch this thing? Like, what order are you going to do it in? So yesterday is a good example. So I wasn't sure which one I was going to concentrate on. Obviously, I'm watching undercards and I'm going back and forth. I'm in my office. I've got all the browsers open. Mm-hmm. I've got the DAZN browser open. I've got the ESPN Plus browser, and I've got the Fight browser. So I can just click screen to screen in my office. And my perspective was whichever main event comes on first, that's the one I'm going to be live with, because I'm writing stories off them also for the most part. So as it turned out, the first main event that started was the Lopez against Conlon fight. So I went with that one as what I was going to concentrate on first. Now, that could have gone 12 rounds. If it had gone 12 rounds, it would have cut into the beginning of the Lee Wood and Lara fight. That would have kind of been aggravating. As it turned out, because it was an earlier knockout in the fifth round, there was actually time from the time that fight ended. I forget exactly. It might have been 20 minutes, a half an hour, something like that, before the actual bell rang to begin the Laura Wood fight. So that was actually perfect timing as far as I was concerned, because it gave me a few minutes to, you know, get some of the quotes and digest sort of what had occurred and then get right into the other fight. The Billum-Smith one I had on the other screen, I couldn't pay close attention to that because it was happening around the same time. And actually, to be quite honest, that was the one of the three fights that were all sort of on at the same time that I was least interested in.
Okay, but for me, I was also interested in, you and I were on opposite sides of the aisle. I had Billum-Smith, you had Okoli. I was interested in, and in the timeline, that one started after the Conlon knockout loss and ending. That one started up and was probably, Dan, about three or four rounds in before the Wood fight started. So you did get at least some separation of, okay, you've seen the ending of Conlon, you've seen the beginning of Billum-Smith and Okoli, and now the Lee Wood fight is beginning. So it was a lot. It was a ton to keep up with. And you wrote about it on your Substack, and we wrote about it on bigfightweekend.com. Shout out to the guys helping me, Ricky Carroll and Sadiq Ahmed, who were helping write all of this, because we even had chaos later on with the Golden Boy shows. And you got to have help. You got to have extra eyeballs. We're not all Godzilla like you are with
at least the Rocha fight did not, you know, that was didn't start until much after later. The other stuff was all done. So that was good. And that was a good way to end things off.
Okay, so let's begin here. And by the way, thank you for finding us. Make sure you're following. Make sure you're subscribing. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. We come off the weekend, even on a holiday here. And we did come early. We are promoting this. We came early because it's a Memorial Day holiday. We're honoring those that have fallen in the line of duty in the military, or first responders, police, etc. We're honoring them. So it's a national holiday, a traditional national holiday for us. So in our case, Dan and I are like, look, we got everything that we need to get the show going. Let's go ahead and do the show, because there's stuff for the holiday and everybody's out of their routine, and get the show out on Sunday night. So peeps, I hope you're taking advantage of hearing us on a Sunday evening, when typically this would be overnight Sunday into Monday before you hear the show. But Monday is a holiday. So that's why we're here in the time frame where we are. So let's begin with the Luis Alberto Lopez knockout of Michael Conlan. Up front, you and I both believe this was going to be a Conlan decision win. We picked it on the BetUS show. Action-packed fight, and in the end, Lopez ends up catching him with a booming shot, a one-punch, a one-hitter quitter, like we like to say, right? A one-punch KO, and he retains the title. Your thoughts in a recap mode?
My thoughts were, I could tell after about the second or third round that this was not Michael Conlan's night. He looked really bad. Lopez looked really sharp, took the shots well, just never let Michael Conlan get into any kind of boxing rhythm. And I mean, Michael has no problem fighting it out with a guy, but Michael's bread and butter, he excels at being a boxer. He's not a big puncher, but he knows that. You know, he's shown that throughout his entire career. And Lopez is the opposite. Lopez is the guy that tries to come and get you. He's got a lot of knockouts. You know, he did go the distance when he won the title against Warrington, but he inflicted some damage in that particular fight. But I just didn't, I mean, I was like right away pretty much at the beginning of this fight, I just did not like Michael's body language. I just thought he was getting hit too much. He was not defensive minded at all. He wasn't getting away from the shots. He never established the distance to keep, or at least try, I guess, to keep Lopez at the end of a jab, and it was all downhill from there. You know, good heart, and he tried, and he hung in there, but at the end of the day, there's only so many of those big punches you can take from that kind of those kind of shots, and, you know, in the end, that big uppercut just ruined him in the fifth round.
Sure, and you and I were not there. You were not covering this, so we don't know it as well. Did it appear to you, though, maybe weight drained and sapped some? No. Do we just credit bad matchup? Lopez is a bad matchup, and firing back on him, and I mean, what would you speculate as to why he didn't look himself, to paraphrase what you were just saying, Conlan?
Listen, I just think some guys, you know, I don't – sometimes in boxing, there's not a lot of things to read into. I don't try to, like, find every little, you know, issue, excuse, problem, whatever. Sometimes guys just have a bad night, and I'm not saying that this was the case in terms of that he would have won on some other night. Mm-hmm. It just – Michael Conlan didn't have a good night.
Or bad matchup, and maybe it was a bad matchup. The guy could take your shots, and the guy's firing back, and it's a bad matchup, and you find that out in the middle of the fight.
He's been in with other good fighters that are good punchers also, and he hasn't had a problem taking the shots. So I don't look at it like that. I think this was actually the perfect matchup for him. I mean, this was the kind of fight that Michael – you know, can, it's not a complicated opponent. It's not a guy that's much bigger than you or, you know, has, you know, tremendous amounts of experience. I mean, Michael's a tremendously experienced fighter in terms of his two-time Olympian with a medal and plenty of experience in the professionals fighting in you know, big crowds and against good opponents. No, sometimes it's, you know what? You go in the ring and you're not yourself. You don't feel so great. Whatever the issue is, the other guy gets credit also. I'm not making excuses. I mean, Luis Alberto Lopez, he did what he does. He throws, you know, he's an aggressive puncher. His defense sucks, but his hands are down. But, I mean, it's effective. I mean, I'll tell you, it's like Jamel Herring. Jamel Herring, who was doing the analysis for the ESPN Plus broadcast, said exactly what I was thinking. Luis Alberto Lopez's offense is his defense, because he's so wild with his shots. They come from all kinds of angles. Mm-hmm. He throws the shot from his hips that it's, you know, and he throws with both hands. And so he's constantly pressuring you. So we don't allow him He doesn't allow the opponent to get back to him or get into any kind of groove. And that's effective for his defense because he keeps up that pace and that pressure. And the bottom line was Michael Conlon, I have to assume the game plan was to go and box him at a distance. Mix it up occasionally if you have to, but stick and move and stick and move and do that for as long as you can, as good as you can. And Luis Alberto Lopez wasn't having any of that. He was not going to allow him to get into that kind of groove. And you could tell after about two rounds that Michael Conlon was going to be troubled for however long this fight went. And then he ducked down into that wild uppercut and he paid the price and he went to sleep for a couple of seconds there and the fight was over. And in fact, the referee, before the referee could even begin a count or wave it off, whichever. I mean, obviously, he's probably going to wave it. You saw the towel from the corner from Adam Booth, the trainer of Michael Conlon, come flying into the ring. And you could tell also, by the way, after round four, when they went to the corner, that Adam was a little concerned. And, you know, you don't usually see urgency from a trainer after four rounds. But it felt like there was some urgency, like Adam knew, you know, we don't have it tonight. And that's the deal. And now the problem that Michael faces is now in his two biggest fights, both in world title matches, this match three fights ago against Lee Wood, a fight he was winning, but also got knocked out even more spectacularly than he got knocked out on Saturday. Where do you go?
Yep. Two biggest fights are both KO losses. He's got to start over. And he said he had a social media post early Sunday that basically said, I'm going to take some time away from everything, including social media, and reevaluate where I go from here. And we'll see. I mean, certainly he's young enough that he can, you know, rebound, refocus, but he's got now a lot to get back in order to get back in a world title fight.
I'm not sure. He's not young. He's had a ton of amateur fights. Mm-hmm. He's in his 30s. This was his best opportunity. It's not to say that he can't get another shot. It's like, right. What is his, does he really want to go through that effort to climb that mountain again? He's not getting any younger. He's taken punishment now in some fights. And let me tell you, Michael's a very, we talked about on the podcast the other day when we were previewing of what a fan favorite he was with the Irish fans in particular, in terms of the way that things went when his pro debut with the giant electrifying atmosphere that they had filling up the Madison Square Garden Theater. And Michael has been a fan favorite for a long time, whether he's been fighting in New York City where he drew lots of fans or he's fighting obviously in Northern Ireland. Michael's a good dude. I like him. He's a very likable guy. And his brother, Jamie, who's now used to be a professional fighter, but now pretty much is Conlon Boxing, which is the promotional outfit that works with Top Rank on their events. So listen, I wish Michael Conlon absolutely nothing but the best, a good dude in my mind, a hard worker. But Luis Alberto Lopez, you know, people write him off. You know, we picked against him. This guy is the road warrior, man. This guy now has all three of his championship victories have come in the enemy territory. Yep. Went to London and annihilated Isaac Lowe in the elimination fight, which got him the opportunity to fight for the title. Took a couple of tune-up fights while he was waiting to get the shot. Then for the title fight, went to Leeds, England, the fortress where Josh Warrington is from, fought him in his hometown and outfought him and outslugged him and outboxed him and won a majority decision. That really should have been a unanimous decision. You know, when you go to a guy's hometown like that, you win the majority decision. You know, that was really a clean win. And then in his first defense, he didn't have a celebration homecoming fight. He didn't take a soft touch or just pick an easy mark. No, the guy went in with a very quality, reputable, legit contender in Michael Conlon and did it in Michael Conlon's hometown. And this is not like just any old hometown. This is Belfast, Northern Ireland, where they don't fuck around. And yes, he knocked him out, you know?
Yep. Bad 2 weeks, by the way, for the Irish fans, the Irish and the Northern Irish fans, because Katie Taylor was beaten last week in Dublin, and now Michael Conlon knocked out in Belfast.
Even on the undercard of KD with Gary Culley getting knocked out, mm-hmm, was a big surprise. So, but the good thing if you're an Irish fan is they've got a lot of good young prospects coming up, and even like Katie Taylor, she's still champion at 135 pounds. So all is not lost.
And Conlon again is 31, 20 pro fights and 31. It's not like he's 35. So let's see if maybe he does not reemerge after these two knockout losses, combining it with Lee Wood. We'll see. For Lopez, just give me one quick thing and we'll move on for here. What do you think is next? Because there are some Top Rank options potentially, and he's a Top Rank fighter. What do you think is next off the knockout?
Well, I mean, there's first of all, they're going to have a conversation with him. What does he want to do? What are his expectations? I mean, it would be nice, honestly, if he could actually get a fight that was, you know, not in his home, in the other guy's hometown for a change. Whether that means fighting, I don't know about in Mexico, but somewhere in the United States, in a Hispanic area, Las Vegas, right, the West, California, whatever. But I think, look, they have other champions that they work with. They are the promoter for Robeson Ramirez.
There you go.
I don't think that's it. I think the logical fight that would be interesting was the loss that he took. Now, Luis Alberto Lopez has had two defeats. One of them was very early in his career, back in 2018 in Mexico. His most notable loss, which came the following year, but that was a nationally televised fight in the United States on Showbox. He lost a decision to Ruben Villa, who then and later fought for a world title and lost. But Ruben Villa recently signed with Top Rank, made his Top Rank debut just in the last couple of weeks, and looked very, very sharp in getting a victory. And he's a very solid prospect, a solid contender, I should say. So I think eventually that might be an attractive fight for Lopez to try to avenge his loss to Villa, and Villa getting another title opportunity. I can absolutely see that fight happening. And then they may also go the route where, you know, we just want to make a good, exciting fight, but a fight where Lopez is probably going to be the favorite. Look, they promote Joette Gonzalez, who has also come up short in some title fights, but he always gives a great effort, always is in an exciting fight. And that would be a very fan-friendly kind of fight. I could see Top Rank looking to that direction. He's going to have options, whether it's a Villa, a Joette, a unification against Robeson Ramirez, which obviously, if that were to happen, it's probably a ways away. And I say that because Robeson Ramirez is first headed to Japan to defend his title on the undercard of the great matchup between Inoue and Stephen Fulton. But suffice it to say, the Top Rank stable between fighters at 126 pounds or other fighters at 122 that could come up in weight, whatever, there are a lot of opportunities and options, I think, for him. The other unification fights seem a little bit unlikely for different reasons. You know, I don't think they're making a fight between him and Lee Wood, although I would certainly embrace that. I mean, you never know, I guess. So that's probably unlikely. And like I said, Robeson's got the WBO title.
Would Lee Wood come stateside, come fight in Las Vegas? I don't know that Lee Wood would ever come fight in Mexico, and I don't know the money would be there in Mexico. Lopez turn around and want to go back to the UK again for a big payday and fight Lee Wood? And again, well, that's Top Rank against Matchroom too.
I'm sure that based on Lopez's comments prior to this fight and after this fight, that this is a guy who is utterly fearless. He doesn't care about going to the hometown or wherever. I assume if you pay him right, he'll go. Lee Wood coming to the United States to fight him, I don't think Lee Wood would be fearful of that at all, but he made it very clear what he wants in his post-fight. There's not a big amount of money to come to the United States to fight Lopez. That seems a bit a bridge too far. Well, Lee Wood wants, and we'll get to it, but he wants the big city ground stadium fight where he lives in Nottingham, and he also would like a unification. The other champion in the weight class, for what it's worth, is with PBC, and that's Ray Vargas.
And so I don't know how makeable, if that's makeable is the right word, listen, that would be. All right. So
let me just say, if I had to bet something on it, mm-hmm. when Lopez comes back, he's going to fight one of the Top Rank guys, probably not going to be a unification in the next fight. He's most likely going to fight one of their contenders, a Joette, a Ruben Villa, and maybe I'm forgetting somebody, but I'm sure there's somebody else that's there also. It's going to be that type of fight. We'll see him on ESPN in a title defense.
All right, fair enough. So let's move to the Lee Wood victory over Mauricio Lara. Now, you and I, we pull the curtain back all the time on this. You and I put the podcast to bed on Thursday night, overnight into Friday for the preview. And we did not know. We did not have any inkling that there was a weight problem looming with Mauricio Lara being significantly overweight the week before the fight and the week of the fight. To the point that we find out later Friday that the British Boxing Board of Control on Wednesday had basically told him it is unsafe right now for you to try to cut all the way down to 126 pounds. We're not going to let you, Mauricio Lara, be any less than 128 and a half pounds, or we're not going to sanction this fight. We're not going to let it go forward. And so we didn't know that. So we put this podcast together. We do a tremendous job, if I do say so myself, you and I, previewing this thing. And it turns out we have a weight debacle, W-E-I-G-H-T, a weight debacle, not a W-A-I-T, a weight debacle to wait on the fight.
Is this a spelling bee? What's going on?
I guess. We have a weight debacle. All right. So that unfolded while we were doing the live BetUS show in the hours just before the live BetUS show on Friday to make the wagers. That this would be a non-title fight for Lara. He stripped. The WBA went ahead and stripped him on Friday, as they should have. So the fight, the fight is only a title fight for Wood to win the title, which he did. All right, so let's get into it. And in full disclosure from me, again, in all the craziness, I didn't watch this as closely as you did. I saw the back half of the fight where, honestly, Rafael, enlighten us all, including me, it did not look like from about the eighth round on when I was watching that Mauricio Lara cared very much anymore, that he knew he had lost, he knew he was going to lose a decision and wasn't trying very hard. That was my perception of that. It was Wood just doing whatever he wanted. In terms of outboxing him. All right, what are your thoughts with all of that being said and what it looked like to you now that Wood has captured the decision and gotten his title back?
Well, I would say if you were watching it from the beginning, it would have been your same perspective after maybe about two or three rounds. Look, Lee Wood, if you watched their first fight that took place back in February, up until the moment when he got knocked out by the left hook, he was handling Lara pretty well. He was up on all three scorecards. I mean, he wasn't totally dominating, but he clearly was winning more of the rounds. He might have lost maybe two rounds. If you want to be super generous, maybe three rounds. But the point was, Lee was in control of the fight, and then he got stopped when he got up from the knockdown and the trainer, Ben Davison, threw in the towel with 6 seconds left in the round. And there was some criticism there, but Lee was fine with it. He's like, look, I knew I had a rematch. That was what Ben said he was in it and had his in his mind. We know we can get this back. They made some adjustments. You could tell the adjustments. You know, a lot of times I think fighters and trainers say that shit, but they don't really know what the fuck they're talking about. I mean, not that they don't know what they're talking about. That it's sort of just, it's just words.
It's the cliche thing to say. Yeah. We're going to make adjustments.
In this particular fight, Lee Wood actually, in my opinion, did make adjustments. His right hand was up the whole fight. He was not going to get hit by that left hook with any kind of, you know, that he didn't see coming, like what happened in the first fight. He stayed committed to the jab. They you know that they worked on this, and Lee said it after the fight, that the jab to the body was a huge asset for him. If you look at the way that fight unfolded, he was very reliant on the jab, certainly to the body. Again, we talk about CompuBox all the time. It's a good guide to the fight. Lee landed roughly a third of his punches to the body in the fight. Obviously, that was not by accident. So he did make some adjustments, and they worked. Lee is a superior boxer to Lara, and that showed. He is a little longer than Lara, that showed. He kept him on the outside, but he fought him on the inside when necessary. When the hooks came from Lara, he took them well because he saw them, as opposed to getting caught without seeing it, like what happened in the first fight. And he also made Lara respect his power, because in round two, he put him on his ass. So that was a big moment in the fight also. And so in the end, you have a guy that has shown his power. His defense has been sound. His jab is good. He kept the distance. He was a little bit taller, a little bit longer. He kept him on the outside when he could. He was willing to fight him on the inside when necessary. And it discouraged Lara. And, you know, some would say, well, he was drained from whatever attempt he did try to make the weight, even though he was over. Maybe he was flat, disinterested because he lost the belt, et cetera. That's a lot of, you can say all that, and that's fine. But at the end of the day, when you get in the ring, you do your job. And he did not do his job. And whether it was because he was disinterested or because Lee Wood was kicking his ass, you know, I don't know for sure. What I do know is that Lee Wood did a great job in that fight. He boxed very, very well. He showed toughness, and he won going away. And when you can look at the scorecards and see 118-109 twice and 116-111, I thought 116-111 was awfully generous to Lara in this fight. So for me, this was a huge win for Lee Wood. You know, he never wavered on taking the rematch. You know, we talked about it in the podcast interview that we played on the preview about, you know, taking this fight on just, you know, what, 3 months, like 13 Correct. Weeks, the first fight after getting stopped. You know, Eddie Hearn spoke about it before the fight, and he said after the fight, look, Lee came to my office on the Monday after the first fight, and like, I want the rematch. And he was with Ben, and, you know, in Eddie's words, he goes, I thought he was mad. And I looked at Lee, and I thought he was mad, you know, mad like as in crazy, not upset.
In British terminology, nuts. Exactly. Yes.
So, but that's what he wanted to do. So they, you know, invoked the rematch. Eddie will tell you he wanted Wood to just sit tidy or take a confidence builder or some other fight. And what he wanted to do is he wanted to do the third fight between Lara and Josh Warrington. That was what his preference was. Now it looks like there's a good chance we'll see Lee Wood against Warrington in the next fight. Now that's one of the fights that he mentioned afterwards when he was asked, what do you want? He wanted a couple of things. He said he wants a big fight at City Ground. City Ground is the big soccer stadium in Nottingham where their local pro soccer team, football team has played. I looked it up, by the way, the City Ground, that's FC, what is it?
Leeds.
Nottingham, No.
Or you're talking about Nottingham Forest. Yes, Forest.
Yeah,
yes.
Nottingham Forest FC Football Club has played in that stadium since 1898.
How about that? City grounds. 30,000
seat stadium. So he wants a boxing event there. He said it several times leading up to the fight and several times after the fight. Eddie, I guess, will try to deliver it for him. Warrington could be the opponent for that fight. That obviously be a huge event for the UK. And the other thing he said was, I want a unification fight. He actually was asked, he asked who won between Lopez and Lara. I mean, Lopez and Conlon, because that fight, had ended, an hour or so or 45 minutes or whatever before Lee Wood had emerged as the victor in his fight. So he'd like a unification. I don't know how realistic those are, but certainly the city ground against a Warrington type opponent, or Warrington specifically, I would think is very, very doable. Warrington would be getting another title shot. They're all with Matchroom. They're on the same broadcaster with DAZN. No reason why that fight can't happen. So that would be a pretty big fight. Lee said, look, he's only got a couple of fights left, he thinks, in his career. He's 34. He's not getting any younger. He's having his best days. He considered that victory on Saturday, he said, it's his biggest win, and he's had some, big wins. Listen, and Lee's a nice guy too. Fighters like that are easy to root for in the ring and out of the ring, because they're very pleasant, nice people. He's a hardworking, devoted, dedicated guy to his craft. He was a guy that had taken some upset losses in British title level fights, and nobody really ever gave him a chance to be a world champion. And that's the beauty of the sport. Sometimes you see these guys, and they're good fighters, but you don't see them necessarily as world class, top elite fighters in their division. But what we think doesn't really mean anything. It's what does the fighter think? What's the work he's willing to put in? The adjustments he's willing to make? The sacrifices he's willing to make? Lee Wood did all of that. He became a world champion. He's got knocked out. He came back. He beat the guy, avenged a loss. I mean, how do you not like that story? He's a good dude. He makes a good fight. And I was happy to see it.
Redemption for him. So he gets the victory.
And I don't know what Larry does now, by the way.
Well, and he obviously embarrassed himself by not training nearly hard enough and not cutting the weight early enough for what went on, and now took a one-sided defeat. We'll see what happens with him next.
I mean, the weight situation notwithstanding, I mean, that's never a good thing, but it's certainly not the first time a guy missed weight, even by that much, and it's not the last time. What was concerning was, when you're in that kind of fight, you still have to have some pride when the bell rings, and you got to try. I mean, we as fans, I don't get really too jacked up if a guy loses. A lot of people get crazy. Mm-hmm. Oh, guy, he's exposed. He's no good. This and that, because he lost a fight. I've never had that attitude. Guys, if you're putting two quality fighters in the ring, or even not quality, someone's going to win, someone's going to lose. And the guy that loses, it happens. The thing to me is, if you lose, so be it. But where I really draw the line is, if it looks like you don't try or give a shit. If you don't give a shit, why am I wasting my time watching you? And I watched Lara fight that fight against Wood, who wanted it more than anything, and his opponent didn't seem to give a shit. And that's what offended me. Not that he lost, not even that he didn't make the contract situation with the weight and got stripped and all that. I mean, it's not good. But what offended me as a fan who spends my time and money watching and reporting is, if you don't try, that's offensive to me. And it didn't feel like Mauricio Lara really in any way tried. There was even less energy in his corner. You figure, okay, the corner, they know he's losing. They know he's getting his rear end, knocked around. And it wasn't like he was getting beat up. He was just losing the fight. If he's getting beat up, that's a different story. There was no urgency in that corner at any point that I could detect. And when he went out for round 12, you'd have thought he was in the third round of a light.
So it's fair to say they had checked out as a team, and he checked out as a fighter, probably because of the weigh-in stuff. He knew he was getting stripped. He knew he was getting fined for what happened, and he knew he was losing. He knew it was going to be an uphill battle and a rematch. And
I can't speak to a fine, but what I can tell you this is, if you can't make 126 and you no longer have your title, and you're going to go to 130, now you got to kind of start over. Lara's cachet was, he was this knockout guy at featherweight that kind of came out of nowhere. Now he's kind of got to start over. Now, that's not to say there won't be opportunities for him at 130 if he shows he actually wants to get back in the ring and be a real fighter. So that was as tremendous and as heartwarming and as excellent as Lee Wood was on that day, it was the opposite for Mauricio Lara. Super disappointing. At least with Conlon, the other featherweight title fight, you can't say he didn't try or he didn't give it shit or anything. Michael was in there to try to win.
Of course he did.
He just happened to get outgunned and lost the fight. But there's nothing to be ashamed of in Michael's case. But Lara, you know, he didn't give it an effort, and that was disappointing.
All right, rest of that undercard real quick, and then we'll move on to the other action. Jack Catterall was finally back after his controversial loss over a year ago to Josh Taylor. He won in the co-feature fight, and also Terry Harper. We didn't really talk about a lot in the preview mode, but Terry Harper, the women's WBA junior middleweight champion, had her fight with Cecilia Brækhus last week called off on the morning of the fight because Brækhus was sick. They were able to put her on this show in Manchester, and she did win by 10-round decision over her fill-in opponent, Ivana Habazin. Okay, so those two fights were on the undercard. Anything of note there coming out of both of those, my friend?
Well, as it relates to Terry Harper, I mean, you got to appreciate the difficult situation. She's made the weight. She's gone to bed. She's waking up on Saturday morning to be prepared to go in there and box against one of the all-time greatest women, whoever put gloves on, in Cecilia Brækhus, in defense of her title, finds out the fight is off. And at that moment, you don't know for sure. I mean, am I fighting? I'm done. I mean, I'm bummed out. I'm not getting paid, blah, blah, blah. Fortunately, Matchroom had this event 1 week later. They were able to somehow salvage it. And by the way, when they got Habazin, they got a really a quality opponent in her. It's not like she's a bum. She's fought for the title. She's been one of the better women's fighters for quite a while. She must have been in the gym and, you know, at least close to the weight and ready.
I was just going to say, sometimes your best ability is your availability. She must have been working out and on weight because she only had 6 days to basically make weight at women's junior middleweight.
But it's also, for Terry Harper, from the mental perspective of, okay, now you got to like reprogram yourself and think, I'm going back in, think about another opponent, a different event. But because she'd already made the weight, now you got to somehow hold the weight for a week. Now, obviously, she didn't stay on 154 or whatever she was.
Sure.
Higher 7 days. But you got to be a little bit careful about that. So, but she was a pro. Habazin was a pro. They put on a decent fight. Terry Harper won the fight pretty handily on the scorecards, 8-2 on two of the cards and 7-3. But, I just give a tip of the hat to everybody involved to be able to save the fight. Hopefully Brækhus heals, gets better, and they can do that fight at some point later in the year, which is what Terry Harper indicated and Eddie said they might try to do. So hopefully that works out. So they were able to save that fight. So good for them. And as far as Jack Catterall goes, it's been a long time coming. We've documented, his situation. He hadn't fought for 15 months. He had the big fight for Undisputed against Josh Taylor. Hugely controversial. A lot of people thought that certainly Catterall should have got the victory. He didn't get the victory in any event, but they tried multiple times to make the rematch. It was on, it was off. There was postponements because of network issues in England. There was issues with COVID-related stuff. There was injuries. There was just a lot of different things that happened. And finally, when the last thing that happened, which was an injury to Josh Taylor's foot, and it was going to be another X number of months before the fight was going to be rescheduled, the WBO, which by that time was the only belt left that Josh Taylor had, which he had allowed himself to be stripped or vacated all the other titles because he wanted to have the rematch with Jack to sort of set the record straight because he had taken so much criticism, even though it shouldn't be directed at him since he's not the guy doing the scoring. In any event, finally, when that foot injury occurred and it was going to postpone the fight for another several months, the WBO stepped in and said enough is enough, and they ordered the mandatory fight for him again for Josh against Teofimo Lopez, which will take place next month. So now Jack Catterall is stuck. He finally he parts with his promoter. He signs with Eddie. This was the first fight of that new contract. He goes in there and he beats Darragh Foley, dropped him a couple of times, wins a clear decision, pretty wide, but got in good work after being out for so long. And now the real possibility exists that with the victory, it could set him up for a shot later this year against Regis Prograis. Now, that is not a guarantee, I don't think, because, first of all, Regis has his fight coming up in June. If he wins that fight, there's going to be probably two excellent possibilities for him within the top fighters that are with Matchroom in that weight class. One will be Jack Catterall, and the other one will be the winner of the fight between Richards and Hitchens and Montana Love. So that's going to probably be left up to what does Regis and his team, what do they think is best for them? And it'll be up to Eddie Hearn to present him with offers, and whichever one probably can pay him the most or make it the biggest event will probably be the one that he would take. So, but Jack Catterall is back in business. Good for him. He got a good shake off the rust win against a decent opponent, took care of business, and he puts himself in a great position. And welcome back, Jack Catterall.
Understood on that. Again, we percolate along here on the Fight Freaks Unite recap. So in the chronology, and again, in fairness for both of us, because as I admitted to you before, I didn't get to see a lot of the beginning of the Lee Wood fight. As it turns out, you were not able to monitor a lot of the Chris Billum Smith Lawrence Okolie fight, because again, that was going on in the sandwich in between Michael Conlan's win, which you were trying to write about post fight, and then the Lee Wood fight beginning. So I was locked in on Billum Smith and that fight. What a tremendous battle in Bournemouth, England, on the coastal town where Billum Smith is from, where Lawrence Okolie, unbeaten WBO cruiserweight champion, was putting his title on the line against his good friend. I mean, this was well out there as part of the narrative. They had sparred together. They're good friends. Now they're in the ring fighting. And this one had drama, with Billum Smith, a significant underdog, scoring a fourth round knockdown on Okolie. And Dan Rayfield, he had him in real trouble to potentially stop him. And the crowd is roaring in that stadium, Vitality Stadium in Bournemouth, a 15,000 or 18,000 seat soccer stadium. It was roaring, and it looked like it might have been a stoppage there. Then Okolie seemed to recover a little bit, but one thing he kept doing through the whole fight was clutching and grabbing after he threw the big right hand. He'd throw the right hand, and it was hug time. He'd throw the right hand, it was clinch time. And finally, the controversial referee, Marcus McDonald, had had enough and took a point away and continued to warn him, stop holding him, stop holding him. And then later in the fight, he took another point away for too much holding. Now we have drama for a possible decision. And then we have a couple of Billum Smith knockdowns late in the fight. The first one was kind of questionable, Dan, in the 10th round, where was it more of a grazing blow? But again, Okolie is trying to grab on. He's off balance all the time. Was it a punch? Not sure. All right, the referee ruled that a knockdown. Then in the 11th, it is a knockdown. It's a clean left that drops him, stumbling forward. So now the crowd is roaring. Billum Smith finishes off what looks like a fairly easy win, because the referee, Dan Rayfield, has called not one, not two, but three official knockdowns, and has taken off not one, but two penalty points for holding on Okolie. Now, I know I went to public school math, and you ridicule me, but that's five. That's 5 points right there.
Well, hold on, hold on.
Matter in this decision. That's five.
I went to public school also. No problem.
I understand
there.
That. No, but I mean, even with my non-private school education, my higher learning, a math tutor, that's 5 points. That's significant.
What that means is that the judge that, well, just say what the judge's scores were. I'm looking here. 116,
here we go.
116-107 in favor of Billum Smith. 115-108 in favor of Billum Smith. And then 112-112. But here's the thing. That means that if my math is correct, that means that Okolie, in all of the rounds that didn't have a knockdown or a point deduction, he won.
Right. Okay. So let's delve into this. I got you here on this. So
yeah, I don't know.
I know, but I'm ready to help, because I wrote about this on bigfightweekend.com. Plug, it's right there. So these three judges, this is interesting and this is important, and this is why you love the recap podcast. So the judges are Mark Williams, who is a referee and a judge in Britain. He's an English referee judge.
Bob Williams.
I'm sorry. Keep me straight. Bob Williams. He had refereed the co-feature fight just before that, and then he sat down to judge. And this happens a lot in Britain, with referees alternating as judges in these fight cards. So Bob Williams sat down to now judge the main event, and he judged it, I believe, properly and scored it properly. And in his case, because of the math, again, we go over the math of him having it 116-107. That's 8-4.
He had it 115-108.
He had it 115-108. All right, keep me straight on this. So he had it 7-5 for Billum Smith, and he properly took the 5 points away from Okolie for three knockdowns and 2 points off. That's why it's not 115-113. We're good there. All right. The next judge in this case is a female judge, and I want to get this all right. In her case, she had refereed some. She's a judge of German descent, and that's Diane Milani. Milani had previously refereed one world title fight involving Natasha Jonas and scored it for Jonas on a unanimous decision. This was the second world title fight she's ever worked, and she's fine. She's fine with the math. Here we go with math again. On what we're scoring.
She has a 116-107, which is 8-4, and took the 5 points.
5 points off. All right. Now we get to the American judge, Benjamin Rodriguez. And as much as boxing fan in this country wants to go crazy on the Dave Moretti scoring last week of David Haney and Vasily Lomachenko. How do you get to 112-112, which the indication there again is he believes Okoli, and again, we're not privy to look at the scorecards. We haven't seen the scorecards, the exact cards, but we're taking this with clues that if he gave Billum Smith only 112 points on his card, he's got it 8-4 for Okoli because Billum Smith didn't get knocked down or seriously hurt or points taken away in any of the rounds. So that means the American judge, Benjamin Rodriguez, who's based out of Northern Illinois, who referees primarily in Wisconsin and Northern Illinois. I looked him up through BoxRec. He had only refereed one other world title fight earlier this year in Japan. It was a second round knockout by Jerusalem, the fighter that lost on Saturday night at the Golden Boy Show. So his card didn't mean anything. In the Japanese fight, he traveled to Japan. It was a second round knockout. So Benjamin Rodriguez did not deduct 5 points from Okoli for the 3 knockdowns and the 2 points deducted for holding. Otherwise, he would have had 112-111, not 112-112. And the other incredible thing...
Well, that means that he probably had a couple of 10-10 rounds.
He maybe have had a 10-10 round. And to me, again, you and I have gone over this. You shouldn't have 10-10 rounds. If you're a championship judge, score a winner.
That's not true. That,
score a
10-10 winner. 10-10 rounds are okay. But
not okay to me. Score a winner. You're in a championship fight. Score a winner of the
round. Well, you just don't know the rules of boxing.
I'm not saying it's not allowed within the rules. I'm saying that you should, as a championship judge, tell me who won that round. If one fighter's more aggressive, then give it to him.
But you have to be honest about it. And there are times. Okay. I'm not saying Billum Smith and Okoli is that case. But there's absolutely times where a 10-10
right.
round is.
Fair enough.
Most of the time, that's when you have an opening round, get to know you, nothing happens.
Right.
There's like one punch landed by one guy, 2 punch landed by the other guy. Nothing happened, and like it's a 10-10 round.
Okay.
When I score a 10 round, which is like 2-3 times a year, that's basically the reason. So I'm not, I mean, again, I can't speak to, I haven't seen the round by round of Mr. Rodriguez's scorecard yet, but I do not say that a 10-10 round is like illegal. If you feel like you need to use it, you do it, but it should be sparingly.
All right. And again, I haven't seen his card either, but we have 5 points in question here in 5 separate rounds. You can't get him to 112 with the 5 points taken off. He should be at 111. And again, this should be scrutinized. Here we go back to accountability, the British Boxing Board of Control, the WBO, this referee, because Chris Billum Smith easily won 6 or 7 rounds of that fight to only be given 4 rounds. 3 of them he had knockdowns in. 2 other ones, there was a point taken away.
But
so,
he got the win. That's the difference.
He did get the win, but this judge should be scrutinized. And I wrote about it again on BigFightWeekend.com. Read about it more because the other two judges had it much more in line and took the 5 points off. But this American, it's an American judge in Britain that did this. There should be real questions about whether he should be judging any more world title fights.
I'm looking at this more from the big picture of how disappointing Lawrence Okoli was.
Okay, yes.
Lawrence Okoli is blessed with all kinds of physical talent. He's a very good boxer. He's got underrated punching power, and he didn't use any of it. And when you talk about,
so let me say this: I think two things happened. He was controlling the beginning of the fight. He had Billum Smith backing up, and then he got caught in the 4th round with the left hook. And from there, I think he was cautious. I think he was tentative about getting countered with the left. It was a different fight, Dan. So go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say about his whole career, basically, not just this one particular bout, is that he's always sort of been safety first. If he can go get you because he's got no fear of what's coming back, he'll get you out of there like he's done with some lesser type of opponents that he's faced. But he's like, when you talk about the clutch and grab, like I said, I didn't see the full fight, but I saw enough to understand what Okoli's about. I've seen him fight in other fights also. The clutch and grab is absolutely maddening. It's like he's like the British version of John Ruiz. Throw the shot, grab on. I mean, I sat through a lot of those terrible John Ruiz fights during his day. It's almost like he doesn't trust himself. Like he knows he's got the power. He knows he's got the size advantage. He knows he's got the reach advantage. He's definitely got the technical advantage. And he's like scared that he can't utilize it.
To be countered.
Like he doesn't really understand his own physical gifts in a weird way. It's almost like I he's never been properly trained to utilize what he has. Or that he hasn't grown into his own body yet. Like he doesn't understand that he's as big as he is and as long as he is and as tall as he is and as powerful as he is. And you know, that's on him and his team.
And what Bill was also interesting, by the way,
heart and a good desire. He was there to, he didn't want to disappoint in front of those fans that were all cheering for him. He's got a big heart. He had that big gash over his eye. And, you know, he was kind of like, I feel like his mentality from Bill and Smith in that fight to become a world champion was, I'm not going to be denied. And if you ever watch Chris Bill and Smith earlier in his career, which I saw him fight on some of these undercard fights that I have seen from Britain, you know, he was, in my perspective, was exciting fighter, you know, hard worker, not really championship material, to be honest. And, you know, again, it goes back to like Lee Wood. You know, he believed it and he did it. Good for him. Congratulations.
And it was interesting to hear Sugar Hill Steward in the corner with Okoli, like in the ninth round and the 10th round, he knew this was big trouble because the points had been taken away. And especially after the 10th round, when there was another knockdown scored, he was emphatically F-bombs flying with the coverage on Sky Sports, apologizing for the F-bombs flying, trying to get Lawrence Okoli to get him out of there. I mean, it was almost like Emmanuel Stewart, knock this effer out. Go for it. Let your hands go.
He is Emmanuel Stewart's nephew.
That is correct. He was imploring him the same way. Get him out of there. Because he knew we're probably behind, except, of course, on Rodriguez's card, which was either with or without a blindfold. I don't know. In any event, Billum Smith gets the win. Two more heartwarming parts of this. Again, with the crowd roaring behind him, his mother is suffering and dying from breast cancer, Dan. He admitted this in the build-up to the fight. He dedicated the fight after the fight to his mom. He's in tears in the ring about his mom. My mom got to see me be a world champion. And he has a one-year-old whose birthday was Friday, the day before the fight. He says, what a birthday present for my little guy. I got this belt now. We're going to play with the belt. How cool is that? These guys, they go out there and take these punches, Dan, for our enjoyment or for what we do for a living or whatever, but they're human beings. And Billum Smith, what a moment in his hometown to have a mom dying, to have a little infant, and he wins a world title. Great story. One final time. Just great story on that.
Yeah, and you know, and the thing about it is he's probably going to have to fight Lawrence Okoli a second time.
And they are. Yeah.
The rematch clause, and that's the downside of boxing
I'm Okoli, I'm trying to make sure that's not in Bournemouth again with the roaring crowd and everything against me. Have the fight somewhere else on a neutral
doesn't
side.
Doesn't matter where the fight is. If you can't take the shot and you're going to grab on and hold constantly, it doesn't matter where the fight takes place. I mean,
I'm with you.
Lawrence Okoli has to, and I mean, I'm sure Sugar Hill has worked with him on these types of things. But it just doesn't feel like he understands what he is. He thinks he's the different kind of fighter than he actually displays in the ring. And it's kind of maddening to watch. And I thought that Okoli would win the fight. I'm not like unhappy that Bill Smith won the fight, but you know, Lawrence Okoli is a very maddening fighter because the skills and the abilities are there. My biggest question about him is not his physical attributes and can he do it? It's really what's going on in his head.
That's right. And sometimes in sports in general, boxing specifically, it is the difference between the years, the mental aspect of the game, what happens when there's adversity, what happens when you question yourself, do you train hard enough in boxing, do you have confidence at the plate in baseball, whatever you want to talk about.
I've always said when the choice is, if you had a choice and you were a promoter or a manager or you're signing fighters, which would you rather have? The guy with the A-plus pound-for-pound talent, but the not-so-great head or work ethic? Or the guy with the B talent, but the I'm going to outwork every single person that there is and has that mentality that I'm not going to be denied. Give me the guy with the B talent and the A work ethic, then the other way around every single time.
And probably the guy with the B talent is the one that won this fight. I don't think there's a probably. He was.
No, and then there's the guys you want, which is the guys with the A-plus work ethic and the A-plus. That's, you know, like a Mayweather with the A-plus talent and the A-plus work ethic. That's the best kind of fighter you could have. You know,
no doubt. Canelo in the present day, name them all the way down the list. All right, so there we go. All right, so there's the wrap-up on the WBO Cruiserweight title fight. And Okoli, look, was very gracious after it was over. He said, hey, he beat me. He beat me, and we'll do this again. We'll have it. We'll have a rematch, and maybe that rematch is before the end of this year coming up. All right, let's finish up on the recaps with the Golden Boy Show, which did see a world title win for Oscar Collazo as he captures the WBO strawweight title and made history, Dan Rayfield. You love the history and the nostalgia. 7 professional fights, the quickest ever Puerto Rican world champion. 7th pro fight, he gets the win on the undercard. Alexis Rocha then wins the main event as a welterweight contender on the Golden Boy Show in front of a raucous crowd at the Fantasy Springs Casino in Indio, California. It was a pro Rocha crowd. They were roaring. He got the knockout. All right, your thoughts on the Golden Boy card to wrap up the recaps here.
Well, I mean, that's Rocha's home base. That's where his fans are. They were all out there for him for the most part. And look, when Rocha was first coming up, I watched him a few times, and you know, the Golden Boy people would hype him up, and I'm like, I mean, I don't know if I see an exciting guy. I mean, I see a guy that's good to watch, and maybe he can get to a certain level, be ranked, and that sort of thing. Do I see a future world champion? I am not so sure about that. I have to say, though, over his recent fights, granted, part of it's because of the type of matches he's been facing, but he's starting to grow on me a little bit. To tell you the truth. I mean, he's getting better, it feels like to me. He's doing what he's supposed to do. The one loss he had, which was in 2020, lost a very competitive decision to Rashidi Ellis, who was a very good boxer. That was when Rashidi also was with Golden Boy. Ellis has since gone on and had the loss earlier in the year on the Tank Davis undercard, but still he was a good amateur. He still got a lot of good skills. But since that time in 2020, Rocha, a couple things. He stayed busy. They've had him fighting regularly, and he's come up with some solid wins. He has the knockout against Blair Cobbs. He has the it wasn't that that's a great opponent, but the previous fight against Georgia Shi, where he put him down, I think that was like a face first knockout.
Yep.
He goes in there against Anthony Young, who was maybe not a world beater, but certainly not a bum. I mean, it was a good amateur in his own right and only had a couple of losses, pretty solid guy. But Alexis Rocha, who is sitting there as the WBO's number one mandatory for Terrence Crawford's belt, before Terrence Crawford and the Errol Spence people could finalize the deal for the undisputed title, the WBO and the Crawford people had conversations with Golden Boy and the Rocha team about, because remember, that fight had been ordered by the WBO, but everybody backed off. I think that everybody on Team Rocha and Golden Boy felt like, you know what, we're not going to go mess up this mega fight. And by the way, our guy still needs a little bit more seasoning. So we're going to get him a couple of more fights. We'll step aside. And if we get a chance to fight the winner of Errol Spence against Crawford, great. If we don't, we'll fight for a vacant title. And maybe he can put together a little bit of a run. But the bottom line is every time now Rocha steps in the ring, he is risking that mandatory status to fight for a world title. So he had that on his mind, not on his mind, but certainly there was in terms of a factor in fight. If you lose, your mandatory spot is gone. But listen, Rocha went in there against a pretty decent opponent in Anthony Young and absolutely tore him apart. Looked probably as good as he's looked, frankly. Mm-hmm. Rocha just beat him up, knocked him down. To Young's credit, he got up. He wanted to continue, but the referee, which is Thomas Taylor, who's probably in one of the best referees in boxing, made the appropriate stoppage. And it's just another good win for Rocha. He's exciting. He's got a fan base. He's coming into his own in terms of his talent. And he's going to get an opportunity, whether it's against the winner of the fight between Terrence Crawford and Errol Spence, or it's going to be for a vacant title at some point. This kid's going to get the opportunity. And then Golden Boy has done a very good job moving him, keeping him busy. He comes in good condition. He, by all accounts, is a hard worker. And he's not, he's only 25 years old. It's not like this is an old guy. He's got plenty of years left. He hasn't really taken punishment. Good puncher. Just like I said, the one close loss to Rashidi Ellis. Golden Boy does not have a ton of top names that are headlining type of guys. But Rocha, of the guys they do have, and I'm talking about guys like Virgil Ortiz, obviously Ryan Garcia, Zerto Ramirez, those types of guys. You got to put Alexis Rocha in that spot now because he makes exciting fights. He's a bona fide contender, and he's going to fight for a world title. He brings a crowd. I mean, he pretty much checks a lot of the boxes you want from your fighters.
Fair enough. And again, if I don't know how much you want to give on Collazo winning the WBO strawweight or minimum weight title fight, and again, makes history as he gets the stoppage with Jerusalem injured to the body. Collazo was taking it to him to the body in this fight and gets the stoppage on the stool. Anything else on that in the recap mode?
I mean, Collazo may have only had the six fights going into this matchup, but I think that a lot of people favored him to win, even though Jerusalem was much more experienced. Collazo was a top-notch amateur. He's been fighting real fights pretty much since maybe the first two or three fights he didn't fight anybody particularly solid, but from the time he got to the fourth, fifth, sixth fights, he was fighting like legitimate guys. Like he wasn't on that Lomachenko track where you're fighting, a legitimate contender, your pro debut, and then a world title in your second fight. But he was fighting real fighters, in the very early stages of his career after just like literally like two or three fights. And here's the thing, though, about the strawweight division. And if you can go back and look through history, guys who fight in that small of a weight class typically move a little bit quicker. So the fact that he was matched up in this kind of match early in his career like this and that he won, neither one of those factors really surprised me very much. This was also a mandatory fight. And, You know, we'll see how long Collazo A can continue to make 105 pounds, which obviously is the smallest weight class in the sport. He is already 26 years old. So it would seem that when you get to that age, typically at some point you're going to move up. And we'll see. Strawweight, unfortunately, it's not exactly the sexiest division. There's not a lot of name recognition, certainly in terms of in the United States. There's not a lot of top competition. I mean, sir, if you want to go fight, you know, in Asia, obviously, and there's the majority of the better strawweights through the history of the weight class usually are from places like Japan, you know, Thailand. So I can't get overly excited about Collazo because of that fact. I don't see like there being some big matchup for him, but you got to give the guy props. Early in his career, seventh fight, makes a record for his country, you know, for his island of Puerto Rico, which is a great boxing traditional hotbed. So good for him. But there was a reason why it was the third fight down the card.
This is true. But it's a victory. It's a world title win for him. And we'll see what happens after that. All right, some news.
Trying to make up for it because you didn't want to talk about it in the preview podcast because you didn't, when you were talking about all the title fights
with Collazo in Jerusalem. Well, it was
a title fight that was taking place in America, not
there
overseas.
There was one. That's true. And yeah, as you mentioned, though, it was third on the card. Okay, so some news and then some nostalgia and we're done. And the news also involves, speaking of Matchroom and Eddie Hearn, it's an extension for Diego Pacheco, and Pacheco going to be back in the ring later this summer. Give me something.
Well, I think Diego Pacheco is probably the best super middleweight prospect, young contender out there. I mean, this kid has really developed nicely ever since they signed him out of the amateurs with Matchroom. He's come to now 18-0 with 15 knockouts. There's nothing to be negative about. He's got the size. He's got the charisma. He's got the exciting style. He's got the skills. He's tall. He's rangy. He can punch. I mean, he's young. He's only 22 years old. You know, he already has some, you know, he's bringing along a bigger fan base from the LA area. I mean, this kid is, you know, I can't tell you he's ready to fight Canelo Alvarez, but he's among the super middleweights that will be the next, in my opinion, the next group, you know, after Canelo is, you know, done at the top.
Do you have him ahead of Berlanga right now in terms of prospect status with Berlanga coming along?
Absolutely ahead of Berlanga. No doubt about it. And, you know, listen, I doubt it will happen, but they both are fighting for Matchroom. So maybe someday, you know, the Mexican-American Diego Pacheco against the Puerto Rican Edgar Berlanga, you know, we all know what that rivalry is about. So something to maybe keep an eye on down the road. But Pacheco maybe didn't have the flashy kind of first round knockouts and all the hype that Berlanga had. And by the way, I'm not knocking Berlanga and saying he's not still interested to watch, but if I had to rank them, I would put Pacheco ahead of Berlanga. So it's not dissing Berlanga. I'm just being honest about my viewpoint, but he signs a contract extension. And as part of announcing that contract extension, he still had at least two fights left on his existing agreement. I'm kind of surprised he re-signed because he's in such a great position that he would have commanded a lot of interest in the free agent market, and maybe still would have signed with Eddie, but he probably would have been able to, you know, get more money out of him and do a better deal. But that's between them. But the bottom line is, as part of the announcement of his contract extension, is that he's going to now headline one of the Matchroom DAZN cards that's going to be in Mexico. You know, because besides building him up here in America, you know, they want to put him in front of the Mexican crowd because, you know, he is a Mexican-American. He makes good style, and Matchroom does a handful of cards per year in Mexico. So he's going to headline this card July 7th in Monterrey. He's going to fight a fighter named Manuel Gallegos, 19-1-1 with 16 knockouts. And he'll get a chance to headline. He'll defend like a regional title and, you know, continue to move the chains. I mean, I figure the last two fights of this deal, he'll fight those types of fights to continue to, you know, to learn and to grow. And then come next year, I think we'll see Pacheco step into bigger fights. And as part of that announcement, by the way, Matchroom also announced that they had signed the junior lightweight Eduardo Rocky Hernandez, who was 33-1 with 30 knockouts, who's been a big, big puncher. He used to be with Golden Boy. His one loss, unfortunately, was a first-round knockout, which put a lot of people, you know, sour on him. In any event, he gets this opportunity with Matchroom. He is number one in the WBC, so he's in a very good spot to fight for one of the titles at 130 pounds, and he will be in the co-feature. So he got two exciting knockout guys, you know, both Mexican background. And listen, I have to say, sometimes even you don't know who the fighters are on the cards. The cards that Matchroom has put on that have been in Mexico, like literally every single one of them has been a good show to watch, including that great fight with Nanchinga when he won the 108-pound title and what I picked as the 2022 fight of the year. So I'm even though they're not fighting like huge names, like I love watching Pacheco. I've gotten to like him a lot. And Hernandez, you know, it's either getting knocked out or knock the guy out. So we'll see what he can do as he tries to move on to get this title shot at 130.
We're about excitement. We're about big punches, big moments, and excitement. And so we're looking forward to that for July on that DAZN card. All right, before the nostalgia, are we really going back to Tyson Fury?
We have to.
Because Tyson Fury.
We have to do it for the people.
But I mean, Fury has like run out of, the only person he hasn't called out at this stage is the boxing guy, Dan Rayfield, for a possible opponent this summer. All right, so he's talking about Anthony Joshua again, and maybe it would be in the fall. All right, so, I mean, how much credence do we put in this, besides the fact that Fury wants his name out there and loves being on social media and throws names out?
Well, he's been throwing a lot of names out because he went to Australia in the last several days because his good buddy and sparring partner, former WBO champion Joseph Parker, fought in Australia and scored a first-round knockout a couple of nights ago, and Fury made the trip and was there. And so there was a lot of conversation in the Australian media. He was talking about I want to fight in Australia, maybe he'll fight against, and all the names came up. Jai Opataya, the cruiserweight champion, maybe would move up and fight him for the heavyweight title. Then they were talking about the Australian fighter Dempsey McKean as another possible one.
A former sparring partner of his, right? And that's where the Australian media is trying to connect the dots.
I don't know if they sparred together, but I know that Dempsey McKean is a big, strong guy with very limited skills. Opataya is not nearly as big, but a lot more skill. But those are the Australian guys. And now he's on social media once again saying, I'm not going to make a deadlines and go crazy with this, but I want to fight Anthony Joshua. He claims that they sent a contract to the Matchroom people. Eddie Hearn refutes that, says, no, we haven't gotten a contract, but I have been in touch with George Warren, which is Frank Warren's son who runs a lot of the Queensberry business, and that they're talking about doing that kind of fight in September. But again, it's there's so many things percolating because there's also still the possibility that Joshua, Eddie says, may still fight in August, talking about doing a Dillian White rematch, and then perhaps a big fight against Deontay Wilder come the fall in Saudi Arabia. So there's so much stuff going on, but Fury once again, and you know, shame on Tyson Fury because he had the opportunity to fight for the undisputed title against Alexander Usyk in April, and they blew it because he was being, as Usyk says, greedy belly on the terms of the rematch. And now he's aced out because he's heavyweight champion. Yes, we acknowledge that. He's a great fighter. Fair enough. But he blew the fight with Usyk, in my opinion. It wasn't Usyk's fault. He tried previously to do a Joshua fight, sent out like 8,000 messages on social media. That did not take place. He's lost out on the prospect of doing another fight that had come up as a title defense against Zhang Zelai because Joe Joyce exercised the rematch right. So that took him off the table as a Fury opponent. So all the different guys that sort of had gone by the wayside, and you're not left with a lot because I'm sorry, but Tyson Fury fighting in Australia against Dempsey McKean. Okay. That's, you know, he's a world champion, nothing wrong with travel in the world, but that might excite some people in Australia. But I don't even think that fight would excite people in the UK. It would be a non-entity. It would be almost irrelevant in the United States. So, you know, he could do it if he wants. But, you know, Fury just got to figure out what he wants to do. And when he does that, you have to negotiate a deal that you can live with. You know, people forget sometimes negotiation doesn't mean you get everything your way. The whole idea is if both sides leave a little bit unhappy with the deal, that's probably a good deal. And he's been unwilling to do that.
Well, but at this point, it's either find a fight with somebody or sit and wait until late this year for the chance to fight Usyk for the undisputed. And we'll see. We'll see if he wants to sit and wait that long. But you're right. He's got nobody. I mean, we're saying this and we were saying it at the time. He's got nobody to blame but himself that the Usyk fight didn't happen in the first place in late April. And now you're crying about you don't have a fight and you're trying to fight somebody. And I'll put it bluntly with you. I don't have to see Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua. I think Fury wins the fight easily. And I don't think it doesn't prove anything. Even if it is in the UK to an extent. It's not as big a fight when Joshua's now been beaten three times and now has no titles. And I think Tyson Fury would probably beat him decisively. And at that point, it doesn't really prove anything because Usyk's already beat him twice.
Still a fight that people want to see. But the point here is this. He's already had the three fights with Wilder.
That's right.
Unlikely. That's not the next fight.
And that, and those, that, and
I'm gonna run through the guys. Let me run through the guys.
They're talking about maybe having this double header where Wilder would fight Anthony Joshua. If you're Wilder, why are you not waiting to see if Alexander Usyk will fight you? I'm just putting this out there. See what you think of this. Why are you not waiting to see if Alexander Usyk will fight you while Tyson Fury's messing around, floundering, and trying to fight Anthony Joshua? What do you think of that scenario, my friend?
Well, because Anthony Joshua fighting Deontay Wilder, even as a non-title fight, is worth more money than him fighting for the title.
Even against Tyson Fury?
No. Deontay Wilder fighting Alexander Usyk for the title, in my opinion, is worth less money than
Deontay Wilder fighting Joshua. Okay, I got you.
Yeah. But if you, but in terms of Fury, he's not fighting Wilder for the fourth time. I mean, maybe down the road, I guess, but certainly not now. Usyk is already off the table. Dubois is off the table because they're fighting each other in the mandatory. I just mentioned about why Zhang Zelay is off the table because he's going to, you know, been in.
Is he going to come back around to Andy Ruiz?
Well, hold on. you got the fight between Joyce and Zhang. So Joyce is off the table also, and he's coming off a loss anyway. So he probably wouldn't be in the line for the heavyweight championship. You mentioned Andy Ruiz, who apparently has asked for, you know, the sky, the star, the moons, and $20 million. So that seems like not likely, obviously, for a lot of reasons. You just go on down the list. Deontay Wilder, I mentioned the Joshua fight. He's trying to restart those talks, but he obviously, from what Matchroom, you know, Eddie Hearn has been saying, they're looking at other possibilities, a Dillian Whyte rematch, which makes sense for Joshua because it was a good fight when they fought before Joshua won the title. Tyson Fury already beat Dillian Whyte, so he's not a possibility. I mean, maybe Tyson Fury will give us a fourth fight with Derek Chisora.
Yeah.
That's a joke.
Yeah, that is a joke. But at this point, what other options are there? Okay, some nostalgia, and then we've got to go. I know your heart tugs at this weekend at the passing of Johnny Tapia 11 years ago. Special thing, you put it on social media, you wanted to commemorate the passing of a former world champion that lived a troubled life outside the ring, for sure. Battled drugs. There was no secret. They've made documentaries about him. Go ahead with more.
I just feel like when you have those types of anniversaries, when you're that type of fighter, you know, people, you don't have to like reflect on it forever, but you should just remember it. I mean, and take a minute, think about it. And he gave so much entertainment, so much joy, so many great fights. He was a tremendous fighter. You know, that's what we know him for, because he won world championships in three weight classes. He unified titles. He was in a number of major fights, had, you know, was on HBO regularly, was on Showtime regularly, fought on ABC, fought on ESPN. You know, he was known to the boxing public. He had a lot of fans, you know. But the thing about Johnny also, and I was fortunate, I got a chance to know him a bit through the years. This is just, I mean, yes, demons to be beyond. I mean, you don't want to talk about people that have troubles. This guy had troubles that on top of troubles, on top of troubles, on top of troubles. All kinds of issues. But such a good heart. Such a nice guy. I mean, yeah, demons, obviously. But just a pure soul, if you will, in that sense. Like the most likable guy you could ever meet. I mean, I have good memories of like hanging out with Johnny and interviewing Johnny. And, you know, I didn't really get a chance to cover many of his fights in person. But I saw him around a lot of fights. I interviewed him several times. Just a great, great guy. I have this one great memory of, I don't remember what fight it was, but I was in Las Vegas for some huge fight. I think it was an Oscar De La Hoya fight. And the late, great Dean Chance, the former baseball pitcher, Cy Young Award winner, who ran the IBA, which was one of the fringe sanctioning bodies, which he always used to bust my balls about because I wouldn't really recognize it. But I still love Dino. He was a great guy. We hung out. We talked all the time. He was the kind of guy that would call you up like 2 weeks before a fight where he was going to be. He goes, "Big Dan, are you coming to the fight?" He'd be like, "Yeah, I'll be at the fight." He goes, "Oh, good. We're going to go have dinner on Friday night," or whatever. He's just a great guy. So he had a gym that the IBA rented or bought or whatever, a property in Las Vegas. And anybody that had an IBA fight, or even if you didn't have an IBA fight, I guess, they would open it up in this private area and you could come and use their gym to work out during the week of your fight. And the night before this big fight in Vegas, they had a big barbecue. And Dean invited like a whole bunch of people. There were probably like 50 people at this barbecue. We went over like after the weigh-in or something like that. And I never forget the image of me standing there, like having like a lemonade, and I'm hanging out and just talking boxing with my boy Max Kellerman. And Johnny Tapia walks in, and he walks over to me and Max. Is, you know, he's making his way through the crowd and he sees us. And you know, not that we were like best friends, but he knew us obviously. And he walks over, and now I'm a big guy, and Max is, you know, not a small guy, and Johnny is like a small guy. He was like a freaking bantamweight, and like, you know, a junior featherweight, whatever. So even not fighting, maybe he's like, you know, 140 pounds, but short. He comes over and he hugs both of us at the same time. Like, I just have that crazy image. He's like hugging Raphael and Kellerman at the same time. And that's just the kind of guy he was. He was big on, you know, loved the hugs and kisses and just as gentle a soul as you can meet. And so when I realized that it was the anniversary of his death on Saturday, you know, it made me think. And, you know, we all talk about, like, should guys retire in boxing? You know, are they taking too many punches? Is it too much? We want to be able to talk to them later in life and, you know, make their money, make their legacy, and get out with their health intact. The only guy I ever thought should never, ever retire was Johnny Tapia. Because as soon as he was going to be done boxing, it was going to be bad for the rest of his life. Mm. Because the boxing sport and training and preparations for fights and was the only thing that gave him any kind of structure, like going to a training camp or going to the gym. And I figured, fight as long as you possibly can. And he used to talk about this. The only place that he ever felt peace, which is really sad, was in the fight during the boxing match. Like, in the chaos of the fight, he feels at peace, which is unfortunate. But that's why I always felt that no matter where he was, and he never took, even though he was, you know, had lost some fights, wasn't the kind of guy that took like immense punishment. And I felt like, you know what, Johnny should fight for as long as he could. And as the reality was, he was not fighting super top elite fighters. But before he passed, and I felt like he was going to fight again for sure, he had won, I think, 4 fights in a row. And look, bantamweight champion, junior featherweight champion. I was there ringside in New York when he won the featherweight belt against Manuel Medina at the Madison Square Garden Theater. And he cried like a baby after that fight because he knew how big a deal that was for him to get the third title. He never defended that title. Instead, he took the big payday against Marco Antonio Barrera and ended up getting stripped of the title because he didn't make the mandatory. But he obviously, it was a much, much bigger fight, and the money was so big for him, he couldn't turn it down. But Johnny had a great career. He fought a lot of big names. And listen, he may have lost on the scorecards, but a lot of people thought he won those fights. They were super close. He had a fight of the year against Paulie Ayala, his great rival, and they fought 2 tremendous fights. He had the huge win to unify at 115 pounds against his Albuquerque rival, the younger Danny Romero. And by the way, I picked Romero to win that fight big time. I thought he was going to just beat Johnny Tapia up. And, you know, we talk about what some of our best picks are, some of our worst picks. Me picking Romero that night, that was a bad that was a bad pick for me. I wasn't covering boxing back at that time. I was still working as a sports writer in Binghamton, New York, but was really into that fight. And that was a huge deal. And by the way, you can make a really strong argument that in the history of the junior bantamweight division, that he's at worst, like in the top, certainly in the top 5. For a long time, it was really like a 2-man race. It was either Johnny Tapia or Kaosai Galaxy from Thailand. Now, you can maybe at this point, you can maybe put a guy like Chocolatito in the mix, maybe a Juan Francisco Estrada, if you what you think about how their 115 pound fights worked out. But Johnny Tapia is way, way up there in terms of the greatest of all time at 115 pounds. And I never get tired of reminiscing and thinking about Johnny Tapia.
Keep him alive on Memorial Day. We always want to keep the memories alive of those that we've lost in the case of military and first responders, et cetera. Listen, we've gone for a while. There's one more piece of nostalgia. Now, just promise me that we're not going to go for 30 minutes because I'm as big a Rocky fan as you are. All right. So today, as we tape this, 41 years ago, May 28th, 1982, was the release of Rocky III in theaters. Rocky against Mr. T, ultimately, or Clubber Lang, ultimately. You even put in the rundown the greatest boxing movie of all time. First of all, I'm going to take issue with you on that. It's not even the greatest Rocky movie time.
Okay, stop.
There's nothing better than the first. The first that won the Academy Award for Best Picture, that's the best.
It's the best Rocky movie. It's better than any other boxing movie you can think of. It's better than Raging Bull. It's better than Cinderella Man.
You're saying Rocky III.
Rocky III is the greatest Rocky. It's the best Rocky movie.
Why do you say that, though? Because Clubber Lang, because Mr. T makes the movie and
the first movie. I mean, look, the first 4 movies are awesome. First 2, obviously, with the whole back and forth with Apollo. Third fight, of course, with the Clubber Lang scenario and the death of Mickey and him getting together with Apollo to become his trainer. And then, of course, Rocky IV, where he goes and saves the world from nuclear war between the United States and Russia with Drago and all that. But Rocky III is like, it was the, you know, the first two were the one storyline. Basically, part one and part two is one story. The first fight with Apollo and the second fight with Apollo. So we get to the third movie. Rocky's now heavyweight champ. He's riding high on the hog. He's got all the money. And now someone's coming for him.
I got a swat at you, and completely unrealistic, because now he's educated and now he's a businessman. I mean, he's basically an illiterate Rocky in the first two that can't read, can't function. And now he's like a businessman in the third one. And he's got all these title fights and he's got a mansion. He's got all the stuff going, and Clubber's coming to take it away. That's the point.
Clubber was like, when Rocky was coming up, he was the one that was working hard and trying to make a go of things in his boxing career, while he was also working as a loan shark and all that, or the enforcer for
the loan shark for Tony. Right. Right. Leg
breaker. It's such a great story. Obviously, Mr. T puts in, you know, he became a star because of that film, if you went and made a list of like the 100 greatest lines from Rocky movies, like probably like 50 of them or 80 of them are from Rocky III, number one. Number two, you know, he gets smoked in the first fight. Mickey died. Got him, you know, telling, you know, Adrian, you want a real man, come see me, that kind of stuff. So the trainer dies. He knocks the dude out. He's hitting on the wife. I mean, there was like, Rocky's really down in the dumps at this point. And, you know, he comes back to life and had the greatest, one of the great, what's the word I'm looking for? One of the great sort of plot twists, if you will. Plot twists, that's what I was thinking of. Is Apollo coming to bring him back? Like one, if you give up the title and you beat me, no, I need you to win it back because it makes me look better. And it's some of the great, first of all, the training scenes in that film are phenomenal. But the other thing about Rocky III is the first 10 minutes of that movie is maybe the greatest 10-minute opening of any movie in the history of fucking movies. Eye of the Tiger is playing that.
I'm a big Eye of the Tiger person, and I'm a big Rocky III person, but we got to settle down on the greatest opening 10 minutes of any movie ever. Any sports movie or boxing movie.
No. He's winning all the fights. You realize that Mickey had set up a lot of these fights, you know, that were like against easy opponents. He's making a huge amount of money.
No, wait a minute. You're using the wrong terminology. They was setups. No, they was handpicked. There's a difference between the two.
He's doing the credit card commercials, and he's on the Muppet Show, and he's like rolling around in the grass, you know, making out with his wife.
Exactly. Life is good.
Ducks the position of a Clubber, you know, in the basement lifting weights and hitting the bag and just going to Rocky's fights and getting pissed off when he sees him knocking the guy out and calling him out. It was just so fucking perfect. And then for the fight to end with the rematch and Rocky to obviously win the fight. I mean, listen, to me, I'm a sucker for that. I love Rocky. I love all the movies. That's my favorite. Well, I don't love Rocky V.
Rocky V is just terrible. We've concluded it should have never been made. Agreed.
Yeah, yes. I disavow Rocky V.
Stallone, by the way, has admitted he should have never made Rocky V. He is now in his latter years admitted that.
And listen, and I mentioned to you in the Johnny Tapia section that we were talking about when we saw Johnny at the barbecue and he hugged me and Max Kellerman. So the other thing that Max, you know, I've known for over 20 years now and been a friend of mine for a long, long, long time. We both agree that Rocky III is the best Rocky film. We agree it's the best boxing film. I'll stand by it. I'll die on that hill. Rocky III forever. 41 years ago.
41 years ago, it got released.
I saw it. I think I saw it on opening weekend.
I did.
I saw it in the movie theater.
I was a teenager seeing it on opening weekend. I was an early middle schooler, just like you are. You and I are the same age. We would have been 12 years old ish, right around there.
I was not even 12 yet. I didn't turn 12 until later in 80. I turned 12 a few months later.
All right.
But I remember in the big movie theater in Albany, New York, where my dad lived, and going with my father and some other friends. And I'll never forget that huge screen. I didn't see Rocky II in the movie theaters. I was a little too young, or Rocky I.
Right.
But Rocky III, man, never forget it. The best.
Well, and one of the great, you love all these different lines. One of the great lines from Mickey, and I use this in life and about all these other things, where they're sitting in the house and that this is where the discussion is going about there was setups. No, they was handpicked. Where they're going back and forth about how he's protect. My job was to protect you, is what Mickey's telling him. But what he says to him, Rayfield, is Rock, You went and got civilized. So in other words, like you said, he got married, he got the house, he got the business. You're no longer the hungry fighter that has nothing but the chance to go win a title in the ring. You now have all of life's riches.
Are known for their awesome training montages that are like extended music videos. But the training montage is he's prepping for the rematch against Clubber, you know, and when he pulls Paulie into the pool and he's training in where Apollo trained.
But what's the key? What's the trigger? Because remember, his heart's not in it. Mickey's dead. Apollo's trying to train him. And what's the key? What flips it around? What's the key? The key is Adrian. Adrian is the key over and over again as his inspiration. Like in the second one, when she wakes up out of the coma and she says, come here, and whispers to him, win. And then Mickey, what are we waiting for? Let's go train. So yes, she's the trigger. She's what gets him going to train correctly with Apollo and says, you know, what are we doing here? But
you're missing the point though. The thing was, Adrian is part of that for sure. But the big thing is, when Rocky is like not, his heart's not in and he's slacking off, and Apollo is taking him to like the ghetto neighborhood where he trained to try to get the eye of the tiger back. And Rocky's slacking off and he goes in there and he says, you know, what are you doing, man? What are you doing in the training camp? He goes, there is no tomorrow. There is no tomorrow. That's what the trigger was. And he realized, and then at the end,
you're not remembering the plot correctly.
In the water,
when he's out there running, and then she finally comes and talks to him, and she sets him straight and says, "What are you doing? We got to live with this the rest of our lives. We can't live like this. What are you doing? What do you really want to do? Do you want to go beat this guy, or do you want to be scared for the rest of your life to have fought him?" And that's where it really clicks, and then he's a different Rocky, and then he and Apollo are running in the high socks on the beach, which I don't know if I can ever picture Raphael running in high socks down on the beach. That's a mental image, and I don't know if I want to go there.
You and I hugging in the water? Yes,
running and jumping up and down and hugging in the water, and then we have the fight and the whole event.
Let me say another thing. There's so many great scenes in that film. We talked about the great opening montage. We talked about the training montage, the whole confrontation with Clubber and him when Mickey has the heart attack and he starts hitting on Adrian. We got the training scenes that we talked about. There is no tomorrow. Then we got the fight itself, and we got the rematch itself, and then we got the ending where, remember, the reason that Apollo said he would train Rocky is, I want you to train with me, but you owe me a favor.
Right.
We find out the favor at the end of the movie, and he takes him in the gym. He's like, you know, he talks about how it was hard for a man of his intelligence to live with losing to him by one
you
second.
You said you learned to live with it.
Yes. Well,
I lied.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought the ending was phenomenal, where they went in to settle the score, close the gym, and then they go to throw the first punch, and it again breaks out into Eye of the Tiger. You got the awesome Leroy Neiman artwork with them fighting each other. I mean, what the fuck is there not to absolutely love about that movie?
I'm not saying I don't love the movie. I got to go Rocky before I go Rocky.
I'm going to watch the training montages on YouTube. Right.
But the ending of Rocky II is still such an epic, fantastic ending. How in the world did Stallone come up with? They're both knocked down, and whoever stands up first wins. That was a great twist to the end of that. And then we had all kinds of twists and turns on the third and the fourth one. Great nostalgia.
I love the first four. But if I have to pick one, I'm taking three.
All right. 41 years ago in theaters, March 28th, 1982, and still on cable TV frequently. They'll run the Rocky. Somebody's probably running on one of these cable channels on linear cable. Is still probably running a Rocky marathon this weekend for Memorial
Day.
There's a rule in mind.
If I'm like watching TV on any given night, I'm on the couch or I'm going to bed or whatever, and you're flipping around the dial and you run into Rocky III, you have to just watch it. Wherever you pick it up, you got to watch the rest.
Do it and be happy with that. All right. With that, I think it is a full show. Again, thank you for finding us. However you did so, you got plenty of fight recaps. You got plenty of news and nostalgia. We're back with a preview in June, coming later this weekend for the first weekend in June. In the meantime, read up on Dan's Substack, his Fight Freaks Unite Substack. Read us up on BigFightWeekend.com. Dan Rayfield, have a safe Memorial Day holiday. We say the same to everybody that's out there listening to us. Be safe driving. Don't drink and drive with the holiday, with everything going on. Remember those that have fallen. This is a tough time for those that have lost somebody, a loved one, not necessarily just in foreign wars and battles, but also first responders, police, those that have died in the line of duty. This is what Memorial Day is all about, is to remember them, keep their memories alive, celebrate their lives. We try to do a little bit of that as I get serious here at the end of the podcast. But listen, Dan, have a great week. We'll be back to scrap again in June, my friend.
That sounds good.
We look forward to it. We thank you for finding us. Follow and subscribe to the Big Fight Weekend podcast feed. You've been hearing the Fight Freaks Unite Recap Podcast. Bye.